Hello and welcome to our INE Office Hours call for the month of November. For those of you who are new, welcome. And the purpose of these calls is for us to handle questions that come up about whatever program you're in. So, like, we have some people who are in here who are in the Clinical Mastery of Digestive System. We have some people who are in the Insulin Resistance Program, and we have some people who are in our Nutritional Endocrinology Practitioner Training. So for Nutritional Endocrinology Practitioner Training, since it's a comprehensive program, the questions are all over the map. Any labs that are reviewed are all over the map. For those of you in CMDS, Clinical Mastery of Digestive System, we, I expect that your questions are going to be about the program that you're in. I know some people have submitted labs, and I will talk about that briefly in a moment. So the way that these calls work is that if you have a question while we're on the line, it looks like somebody already raised their hand, you can raise your hand with a star two. You can also type your questions in on the chat, and we've got a chat here right on this instant teleseminar service, and it looks like, yes, you can see. Good. So Susan from Boston said, can you see this? And Tony said, hi, Susan. Hi, Susan and Tony. So we have the chat on here. We also have the ability to do screen share, and this is probably going to be the last one of these where we use Join Me to do it, because we got an account with what's it called? Zoom. And I like it much better, especially if we're going to do a lab review. We can put the lab up on a screen and copy it and make a audio video recording, not just an audio recording. But this time we'll use that. There's a chat over there, and I'm opening up the chat window. Beverly said, good morning and welcome to all the very wise newly joined members and all my great old friends here. Thank you. Hi, Beverly. So what she's referring to, for those of you who weren't at our SHINE conference last weekend, we opened up enrollment for our Nutritional Endocrinology Practitioner Training, and we had about 20 people join, and actually one or two since the event as well. So, and then we had a few join the week before. So for those of you who are here on the call, I echo Beverly and welcome you, and I'm really excited to start to get to know you. So if you have questions, you raise your hand. I always like to handle the questions that have been typed in advance on the site, and for all of our programs, there's a place that says ask the doctor questions for calls, something like that. You just click it in the support and you can type your questions in. For these calls, the other way to give me questions is to just click on the link in the reminder email and then just go to the Q&A there. Either way works for me. The other way is while the call's going on, you may have questions or comments about what we're discussing, and we have the chat. There are two chats right now, which might seem confusing, but because we have the Join Me open, we have, I actually prefer that chat because it's a little bit more reliable. Sometimes the one on Instant Teleseminar, it goes down. They say it's a beta property, which means it's not quite fixed yet. So we have one hand up, and I can't tell where it is. It's just a number. But just string of numbers, so it might be some kind of Google Talk or whatever. I am going to answer the one question that was typed in advance, and that was from Lisa from Henderson, Minnesota. And Lisa, I believe you're in the CMDS program, if I'm not mistaken, and I don't recall yet if you are in any PT2, but you have a question about thyroid. And you've given me a bunch of numbers. And what I'm going to say is I'm pretty quick with labs, but when I see a string of numbers and they all blend together in one line, it's really tough. So in our NEPT program, we have a really nice thyroid tracker that you can put it in, and we have a lab tracker that you could put your numbers in that we could look at. So if you are in NEPT, that's how I prefer to get your labs. If you're not in NEPT, you're in CMDS, most of the questions I would expect you to be asking would be about that program, but I'm going to this time answer your questions. But I would highly recommend if you type anything into the chat or the Q&A box that you list them one item per line so I can actually see them, because these, like, they run together and it just confuses me. But I read it about three or four times to make sure I had it. And Lisa's asking if there's other natural alternatives to improving thyroid function. Doesn't like to take medication, but it seems for some thyroid medication can help. Over the last year, I've been working with the doctor on improving, and here are some thyroid and ferritin markers she tested. So I'm going to go through this quickly because it's challenging, but there's I really need to say that, yes, there's lots of issues with thyroid, but here's the thing with thyroid. You have different kinds of problems. You either have a supply problem where the thyroid's not making enough hormone. You've got a conversion problem where the T4 is not being appropriately converted to T3. You can have a receptor problem where the receptors are damaged and all the numbers look good, but you're still having symptoms. So these are things you have to keep in mind for your own clients. There's also a control issue where the pituitary hypothalamus axis is not actually stimulating the thyroid appropriately. And there's a whole bunch, there's other things with thyroglobulins where the thyroid binding proteins are either insufficient or too much. All of these can throw off thyroid function. That said, when there's a supply problem, while you're looking at why is there a supply problem, what's the root cause of the supply problem so you can help the thyroid to make more on its own, then definitely having some natural, bioidentical, well-balanced thyroid medication from your doctor, from a doctor who knows how to functionally look at the thyroid, can definitely be helpful. You also say that since the February results that you put, you started to take thyroxin and recently switched to Thyrosense Thorn from Thorn. And your doctor's telling you she wants you to take T3, low dose T3, and also iodine. So when I look at your numbers are back in February when you did it, you just did thyroid peroxidase antibody and it was 0.54. Well, 0.54 is a very low level of thyroid peroxidase antibody, and that's the only thing you did back then. After that, you started taking the thyroxin. We don't know what your total T4 was then. We don't know what your free T3 was. We don't know anything except that you had a very low level of antibodies. In May, when you looked, you had a T3 at 28, and I'm going to just read out the key numbers that I'm looking at. You had a free T4 of 1.04, which is in the optimal range, but you had a free T3 of 1.99, which is extremely low. And it's even outside of the lab range, which is like the high, it should be above 2.3. In our functional world, we want it to be above 3. So you're clearly, there's not an issue with supply here. The T4 is fine. The issue is with conversion. You're not converting the T4 to T3 enough, well enough. In October, you did it again, and your reverse T3 went even higher, and your free T3 went even lower. It's down to 1.36. And yeah, you might benefit from taking some free T3, but the issue is you want to understand why. Why is our big question of the day. Why is your body not converting the T4 appropriately to T3? Because your T4 wasn't even measured in October. So again, this doctor is running incomplete lab tests. The one in the middle was good. The May was pretty complete, but the October one was missing some of the things that we would have wanted to see, like T4. So we don't know what your T4 is doing. Then she wants to put you on iodine, which is going to help your body make more T4. But what good is that going to do if you can't convert it to T3, right? So your issue is a conversion issue. We have a whole bunch of information in our Thyroid Revive and Thrive class for consumers. And since this is for you, you might benefit from doing that. You can go to thyroidreviveandthrive.com. We have a whole booklet that goes through all the types of issues and what kind of natural things can be done. But you want to up the conversion. The conversion happens in the liver and the conversion happens in the gut. And then, you know, a small amount of it happens in the thyroid and other tissues like kidney and skin and other stuff. So the other thing that is a red flag for me is your ferritin went from 17.9 back in May up to 116.3. But I don't have your iron, so I don't know what your serum iron is. I don't know what's happening with the conversion from iron to ferritin or ferritin to iron. But the ferritin is high. And that's higher than I'd like to see it. I don't like to see it much more than 30. So is there a liver stress? What's going on that's causing the ferritin to go up? but I don't know what your iron is. So these are very incomplete blood tests. What I would recommend if you want to take this under your own hand is go to the Thyroid Revive and Thrive program and purchase that. You have the doctor redo with the iron and the ferritin so you know what that's going on. But my suspicion here is that you've got a, well, you've got a very poor conversion. You're making too much free, reverse T3, which means that there could be some sort of metabolic process. There could be an infection, serious stress on your body, that's causing that the T3 reverse to go up and the free to go down. That enzyme that helps to move T4 to T3 and or T4 to reverse T3 is the one that you want to favor is a selenium-dependent enzyme, so you may be low in selenium. And like I said, it's done in the gut and the liver, so I'd be looking at your gut health and your liver health in order to get to the root cause of what's going on. And that high ferritin is making me suspicious about liver, because that's where that conversion is and that's where that storage is. Okay. So if you want to get this redone, you want to look at these numbers. You want to address the conversion issue, which we detail in Thyroid Revive and Thrive. We also had a Shine seminar a couple of years ago about the thyroid and adrenal, and you may want to purchase the recordings of that. And I think the way that you would find that is log into INE and click on events and you'll see a list of all the events. And if you already have the recordings, then go ahead and watch them. If you don't, you'll click it and they'll say, hey, you don't have these recordings, but you can purchase them. So that's it. But whether I don't see why she's doing iodine and those minuscule amounts of iodine, I don't see that are going to do any good anyway. But, I would be before doing any iodine supplementation, I will usually go and do an iodine load test. But again, iodine, you need to take some iodine if you're taking selenium with it. Or if you're taking selenium, you should be also taking iodine. So that 450 micrograms of iodine with selenium may help that conversion. But in general, iodine is good, mostly used for a supply problem, like your body doesn't have enough iodine to make thyroid hormone. So that's the story with that one. So what I'm going to do is go to the hand that we have up. And I don't know who you are, so if you have your hand up, please introduce yourself. Hello.
Hi.
Who's this?
It's Steph. I'm in France, so hence the
Oh, hi, Steph. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, hi. So did you have a question, or did you accidentally put your hand up?
No, I did. I submitted a stool test, a doctor's data lab test.
Okay, Lynn, do you have that? I didn't see that in my list of things I was supposed to be looking at. Or was that for you submitted? I'm not sure. Lynn, get on. Help me here. When did you submit it, Steph?
This afternoon. Oh, my afternoon.
Oh, so you submitted it today, which here's the thing, and I need you guys all to help us with this. If you want me to look at a lab, I really would appreciate if we get it 24 to 48 hours in advance, because for us to get that lab taken from where you uploaded it, so I'm aware that it's there, is to let us know what call it's for, but also to do it in advance. Because if we don't have it already uploaded somewhere, it's just going to take up the time on the call to be able to look at that. So, Lynn, do you know anything about her stool test? That's not something I've seen. Lynn, you're muted. Unmute yourself. Lynn, you've got to be unmuted in order to... Lynn, there you go. Now start talking. No, unmute your mic. You're still muted. I unmuted you, but you're still muted on your mic. I can't hear you, Lynn. I can only hear you because I know you're downstairs, and I can hear you vaguely in the background speaking. Check your mic. Well, then come on up here and talk into mine because nobody can hear you. The only one that can hear me, you, is me, because I can hear your voice speaking downstairs. Yeah. So let's hold off until Lynn can get it together and we'll figure out if we have your... Right now? OK, Okay, so it's going to take Dropbox, you know, some time to sync, so we'll have to go on. Yeah. Yeah, so for everybody, please, we do our very best to be attentive and be able to help you and support you in this, but if you submit a lab right before a call, it's really unlikely that we're going to be able to take care of it because it's just, it takes time for us to set it up, and I like to look at things in advance. I don't always have to, but I like to. But we'll look at it in a few minutes. Steph, I'm just going to put you back on mute, and I'm going to see who else I can help.
Okay.
There was another one that came in just hours ago, too, and I think it was from Karen, and I don't see her on the call. Karen, no, I don't know if she's on. Karen, would you type into the chat if you're on? You submitted a 24-hour urine test on hormones. So here's the thing I want to say. We do 24-hour urine analyses on NEPT calls. We don't generally do them, and they're usually done on case study calls because they're complicated cases, and they take a while to do. On these, we're happy to do stool tests because those can go really quickly, so we'll be able to do your stuff. But on these calls, we prefer that if you're in a program, like you're in the digestive program, then the 24-hour stool test is not like the thing that we do. So if you're in NEPT or if you've joined NEPT recently, then we're happy to do it, but it's better done on a case study call. 24-hour urine tests take a while to go through. They're very complicated, and they have a lot of moving parts. And for me to get caught off guard and have to try to analyze a 24-hour urine on the spot, I can do it, but I can't do as good a job. So once I see it, if Lynn's uploaded it, I will give you one or two pointers on it. Karen, I don't know if you're on the call or not, so let us know if you are. But if you're not, then I'm probably not going to do anything with it. So I'm going to look to see. Let's see. INE office hours. Here we go. Karen. Ah, I see Stephanie in there, so it did upload. Okay, so let me do Stephanie's first because it's more apropos for this call. Stephanie, okay, doctor's data. Okay, so what I'm going to do is if we're on, yeah, and again, these won't be recorded until we figure out how to do this, but I will share this and I'll tell you what I'm seeing. So I'm going to share my screen. So those of you who are on, let me see, share window. So those of you who are on, join me. You should be able to see this, and please let me know if you can see it. We can see Stephanie's parasite test and her stool test. This is the doctor's data comprehensive. So what I see here is that there's no bifidobacter. This is super, super important that we have bifidobacter. Let me see if I can somehow record this. Give me a second. See if I can record this on Camtasia. That way, if you're not on the call, you can see it. Okay, let's see. There we go. Let's see if I can just start this recording. Okay, so This is Stephanie's comprehensive stool analysis and parasitology. This is from Doctor's Data. So this is one of the tests that we like, especially because it has so much great information about what's going on. What I'm seeing here right away is that there's no growth of bifidobacter. Bifidobacter should be the predominant in the expected beneficial flora. There's none, really. The lactobacillus is 2+, so it's lower. I like to see these at, two, 3 or 4+ on the good stuff. You've also got no E. coli, and this is the natural inhabitants. So we're really looking at whatever the normal natural inhabitants are, we want to see them in balance. And we have high Clostridia. So the normal flora is way out of balance. So let me open your lineup. Lynn, would you open Stephanie's lineup and let her know when it's open. That way she can chat with me so I don't have to switch back and forth and we can get a good recording. So your good flora are out of balance. So the question I would want to be asking you, and especially if you were not the person here, if this was your client, you'd want to be asking, tell me exactly what probiotics you're taking, because whatever it is, you're going to want to switch it around. Okay, Stephanie, your line is open. Go ahead and say hi and make sure I can hear you.
Hi.
Okay, good. All right. So, what kind of probiotics are you currently taking?
Well, since getting that result back, I've been doing a lot of Bifido. And I did a U-biome test, which seemed to show that I did have lots of Bifido subsequently. So I don't know how representative the U-biome is compared to Dr.
Data.
This
test?
It was in June.
Okay, so it's a few months. So since then, yeah. I don't usually look at the U-biome just because it doesn't really give us specific and all that. I think that this is much more telling. So since then, you've been doing more Bifidus.
Yes.
More balanced. Okay. And then you've got some commensals that are out of balance. So that means that these guys are normally there, but they're in small amounts, and as long as they're in balance, but yours are not out of imbalance. They're in the yellow. They're listed as 2+ or 3+. So sometimes you can just crowd them out. And it could very well be that they're growing because your good normal flora is not taking up the space that it should. So you could address it simply by going and trying to crowd them out. And you can do that with pathogenic flora as well. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But sometimes we have people who are super sensitive. And when you actually give antimicrobials for the gut, they get such bad die-off reactions as those bugs are being killed off and they're releasing their endotoxins that you have to back off. So if you've been doing several months of this, feel like you want to try some other stuff, we'll look when we get to the sensitivities page to see if they've outlined anything that might work. You've also got a little bit of Saccharomyces boulardii. Usually the yeasts don't show up in this section, even the normal flora ones. It's just if they're a little bit overgrown. I'm not so concerned with the 1+, and I think that that would be probably be dealt with crowding them out and not feeding them, yeah, right? So getting off the sugars and starches and maybe even some of the sweet fruits, et cetera, that would be feeding them. Because the microscopic yeast does show few as opposed to none to rare. So there's definitely some sort of a yeast overgrowth here, right? So let's move on and see what your sensitivities show. Oh, look at this. So you do also have some parasites. You've got some Blastocystis hominis, and that's showing up in all three samples. Sometimes we only see it show up in, like, the sample 3, so it's not as profuse. Even though it's just few, it's still there, and Blastocystis is going to affect the normal colonization, and it's definitely something that you want to work at getting rid of. And hopefully they did a sensitivity test a little bit further down so we can look to see what your best bet would be in terms of what you do. Fortunately, no Giardia or Cryptosporidium. Then we're looking at function, and looking at the function, everything's within range. So elastase is a pancreatic enzyme, so you're making plenty of elastase. Very little bit of fat showing up in your stool, so you're digesting your fat okay, or eating very low fat. Very few muscle fibers, so you're probably digesting your protein well. Very few vegetable fibers, and negative for carbohydrates. So it seems overall that your digestion process is working okay. Doesn't mean your absorption process is necessarily working okay, but your digestion. You don't have any really major inflammatory markers. These are all well within the range, so there's not a lot of inflammation. We wouldn't say you have Crohn's or inflammatory bowel disease or anything like that, and there's no mucus, so that's good. As far as immunology, we're looking at your secretory IgA is very low. What that means is that you're not producing enough of an immune response in your gut to help with getting rid of those bugs. So that's why they're probably being able to grow out of control, 31 versus a range of 51 to 206. There are several things that interfere with secretory IgA, and I'll let you know what those are. Number one, vitamin A. If you don't have enough vitamin A, you're not going to be able to make enough secretory IgA. And this could be reflective of your sinus cavity as well, your vagina, your respiratory tract, your lungs, et cetera, because secretory IgA is that protection, that immune protection that lives in mucous membranes. So things that support mucous membrane production could be good. Vitamin A, sometimes vitamin B1 is very good for helping to grow that that lining that helps to produce those immunoglobulins. But also stress will do this. So HeartMath, they've done studies with HeartMath where 5 minutes of going into a HeartMath technique of relaxation, gratitude, etc., can do wonders for your secretory IgA, whereas going into stress and anger plummets it. So the thing so far that I would say for you to focus on would be continuing on the proper range of those probiotics, getting something, some support for your secretory IgA, so vitamin A could be an issue, as well as vitamin B1, and then doing more frequent HeartMath, like interrupting yourself when you feel yourself getting stressed and moving yourself into that de-stress place. Overall, your short-chain fatty acids on this next page are looking good. The ratios between them, the percentages, et cetera, all that looks good. There's no sign of blood or occult or red blood cells. That's good, but your pH is low. So it's more of an acidic pH down there in the gut. Well, that could be a direct reflection on the fact that you have gut bugs out of control. You've got some parasites and candida, and they tend to produce acidic waste products and endotoxins. So that we can look at from that perspective. But I'd also look at and make sure that your diet and lifestyle are producing more of an anti-inflammatory effect. And we have plenty of that information for you in NEPT. You have access to the Foundations program I created for my Energy Recharge program. And in the Nutrition pillar in there, there's a whole section on pH. So you can review that and just make sure that you're doing all the right things for yourself. And then the rest of this. So the next is the fun part, because we get to see what the susceptibilities are. Are you currently taking any antimicrobials for the gut or for anything? Still there, Stephanie? Okay. There you are. Oops, can you hear me? Now I can.
Oh, sorry, my internet cut out and I had to redial in, so I missed a bit.
Oops.
I was taking some antimicrobials. I was taking olive oregano and berberine and artemisinin, however you say it.
Artemisia.
Yeah.
Okay. Surprisingly, they don't test artemisia. So if you look at this, the way that you would interpret this chart is that for the Saccharomyces, if you wanted to have something, be taking something that it was sensitive to and would be effectively hurt by it, berberine is a good choice, but look at where oregano is. Oregano is not a good choice. It's just not sensitive. Could be that it used to be sensitive, but you wore out the sensitivity by taking it. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But you can see that the two that are most predominant here are berberine and grapefruit seed extract. Now, I'm surprised, you know, and disappointed that they didn't test artemisia, because artemisia does tend to be a good one. They probably tested it for the parasites, because artemisia tends to be better for parasites. So we'll see that hopefully on the next page. But I would say the berberine. How long ago did you take the berberine, and when did you stop?
I probably stopped about a month ago.
Okay. And then this test was done in June, so you were taking it before you took this test?
No, I took it after.
Okay, so you started taking the berberine after this test, but you haven't had a big test yet since. Okay, so here's what my recommendation is. Whenever you're putting someone on something or doing it for yourself, you do a test. It says you need a certain thing. You start doing that thing. You don't just stop it and then take the test months later, because you might lose good traction. We don't know when we look at a test how long you're going to have to be taking it for. So I would recommend you get back on the berberine and then continue it. Well, one of two things. You can either redo your test right now, or you can get back on the berberine, do it for like 6 weeks, and whatever else comes out of here, like keep up the higher levels of the probiotics and all that, and then go retest it in like, you know, 6 weeks to 2 months. That's probably the. Okay. Oh, they didn't do. Oh, I'm bummed. They didn't do the blastocystis. They didn't do the blastocystis. The artemisia does tend to work well for the, if you wanted to do that. So if you want to just go ahead and get retested now, you'll see where you are right now and see if this is still valid because you've done a bunch of stuff to address this. Or you go back on the berberine, go back on the artemisia, do that for 6 weeks, and then go back and retest, whichever way works best for you and your schedule and the convenience, your budget, the whole bit. Okay?
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I don't know why they didn't test the blastocystis. That's kind of weird to me. Yeah. Well, all right. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. All right. So... All right, so we're no longer sharing. Let me go back here. Is there a connection between iron and autoimmunity? Lynn wants to know. You know, iron is impacts the immune system. Is there? I don't know of a specific connection between iron and autoimmunity. My guess is that there might be. There's definitely a connection between iron and infectious disease. So you do have to be careful with iron. I'm not a big fan, I guess, of just supplementing people with iron because you think they're low, especially if they're perimenopausal or postmenopausal or male. Premenopausal women can get away with it usually a little bit better. All right. So that was Steph. I'm going to look at Modesto. Is that Jane? You still a Modesto number?
Yeah, that's Jane.
Okay. Hi, Jane.
Question on occult blood on these tests. If it comes up positive, what should I be thinking about? What should I be looking for? I mean, because I'm assuming it could be lots of different things. It could come from lots of different places in the digestive tract.
Exactly. I would say, first of all, start to look to see if you are seeing any hints of it, right? Because they're looking for it on the stool. It could be fissures. It could be hemorrhoids. It could be a tumor in the colon somewhere. It could be an inflammatory bowel condition, but usually you're going to see more overt blood. But those are things you would want to be looking at. If it comes up once but never comes up again, or it comes up once and then you get some of those guaiac, you can go to Amazon and order guaiac strips and be able to test it on your own. I would certainly follow it up that way. So there's any number of places in the gut. It could be an ulcer type bleed. It could be, you know, it could be up further up in the digestive tract if it's in the whole blood.
Yeah, on this particular client, one of the thoughts that's been coming to my mind is doing an H. pylori test in addition to this.
Yep.
Is that a possibility too? It's just what I keep getting on this one.
Well, H. pylori bores its way into the lining and certainly could cause a little bit of internal bleeding, but you definitely want to rule out that there isn't blood somewhere else. I'm not sure if menstrual blood, you know, I think menstrual blood might be, I know it doesn't seem like it's a cult, but it really would be blood that got mixed in with the stool as opposed to seeing it overtly. So that's another thing. Sometimes if someone takes this test when they're on their period or right before or after and they're having some breakthrough, it could be that. But yeah, you want to rule out all those different possibilities. Like you always want to think when you see blood, like, where is it coming from? Where are the possibilities that it's coming from?
Right. Okay. Yep. I'll just go and ask more questions. When you were saying, I didn't quite hear at the top of the bacteriology culture, the commensal flora, if they tend to be low, you said by taking probiotics, you might crowd them out. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah. So they shouldn't show up there at all. I don't see any of them there at all. So they're low level. They're not 4+, they're 2+. I would say oftentimes because her normal flora was so out of balance. She had perfectly balanced normal flora. Then I'd say hit them directly. You do want to do something to get rid of them directly. But since her normal flora was so out of balance, getting her normal flora in balance could create that homeostasis again.
Okay. Cause I have a client who the beneficial flora is, you know, in 3s and 4s. And then showing commensal bacteria, a commensal imbalanced flora, so I should probably address that then.
Yeah, you might want to start gently. You know, it depends on how sensitive this person is, right? Because you don't want to throw
right.
them into an endotoxin overload when you start to kill them
right.
off.
Right. Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. All right. So other questions, raise your hand, star two. Other comments? I'm going to look to see if anybody's typed in any other questions. And then let's see. Daniela, is wheat grown in Europe less problematic? Maybe, but it's still not a good thing. Is glyphosate sometimes the bigger problem? Yes, it could be the problem, but there's also a problem with wheat. If you haven't heard Tom O'Brien speak, he did an amazing talk at our SHINE conference last weekend. And it's basically once somebody has been sensitized to the wheat, whether it's glyphosate or whether it's the wheat itself, it's a problem. And no matter where the wheat's grown, it's still going to cause a temporary leaky gut. It's just a matter of how much that person can deal with it. Glutamates and RLS. What do you mean by RLS? Reflex? No, that's not what that is. So what's RLS meaning? Is glutamine connected to this and can be a precursor to glutamate and GABA? My husband took GABA. He got an irritated feeling. Do some kind of genetic testing for this. And RLS is, I'm not sure what you mean. What's that? Oh, restless leg syndrome. Okay, thank you. There's too many acronyms. I can't keep track of them all. So restless leg syndrome. How does the Lord stuff you? Okay, so let's start with that one. So when he took GABA, he got an irritated feeling. Do some kind of genetic testing for this in RLS in general. Generally, you know, first of all, if somebody takes GABA and it actually gets into the system and crosses the blood-brain barrier, it usually means that they have a leaky gut brain barrier and leaky gut. So that's stuff to look at. Certainly glutamine can be connected because it's, you know, a precursor to glutamate. There's a specific genetic SNP called GAD, glutamic acid decarboxylase, that when that is out of balance, you know, if that enzyme is out of balance, you cannot convert your glutamate to GABA, glutamate to GABA. And so you get a buildup of glutamate. I don't know that GABA to glutamate, I don't know if it's a two-way street. I'd have to look that part up. I'm trying to see the pathway in my brain. If anybody knows, let me know. Glutamate goes to GABA. Does GABA go back to glutamate if there's too much GABA? If that's the case, then certainly that could be contributing. But Dr. O'Brien also talked in our SHINE conference, so if you haven't already purchased the videos or the live stream of that, we still have them available. Just click the link that you got in an email last week. You can watch it, and you can watch his presentation, because he did talk about restless leg syndrome related to gluten, and I'd have to go back and see what the mechanism was that he said was going on. But is it a two-way street? Does anybody know if it's a two-way street, or can anybody look that up real quick to see if GABA can actually go back to glutamate if there's an excess GABA? Some pathways are only one way. How does the lower esophageal sphincter get pushed down by the diaphragm? Well, first of all, the lower esophageal sphincter is part of the diaphragm. It's actually a muscular area within the diaphragm. So it doesn't get pushed down by the diaphragm. Generally, it's either loose or flaccid. If the stomach is coming up through it, like if you've got a hiatal hernia and for some reason the stomach gets pushed up, which can happen in obesity, it can happen in pregnancy, it can happen with mechanical trauma, it can happen with poor innervation to the diaphragm. It's actually the stomach that gets pushed up. The lower esophageal sphincter doesn't get pushed down. It's part of the diaphragm. How do you assess that and what type of body work helps that? Yeah, so if a person bloats soon after as they start eating, okay, so that it can be related to the lower esophageal sphincter. It can be related to low stomach acid, or it can be related to small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So as far as assessing for hiatal hernia, which I think is what you're asking, is you can actually see a chiropractor or some kind of body worker who knows how to do kinesiologic testing for that. So they can do a kinesiologic test to see where it's at. There are some imaging techniques if it's a severe hiatal hernia rather than real subtle, and that can measure it as well. As far as techniques, there are techniques for dragging it down. There are actually some good YouTube videos. If you look up hiatal hernia on YouTube, you'll see some. And a good chiropractor who's been trained in kinesiology would know exactly what to do to help pull that down. Great. Good question. Let me say refresh. Okay, I don't see that. Let me see in the chat here. Okay, Jenny says, how do I update lab results? I'm not sure what that means by update your lab results. Beverly, can we ask them to test more agents like artemisia, for example, or other agents we happen to like when we send the sample? I don't know. I mean, that's a really good question. You can certainly try it, meaning the lab, like saying, hey, can you test artemisia? And I'm also taking these other things. Can you test it? I don't know. I really don't know. I've never asked them. I don't know. I think that might not be a bad idea, Beverly, to call them and say, why didn't they test for sensitivities to the blastocystis? Because it would be good to know if the artemisia is going to work or other antiparasitics. Ambika, will there be another opportunity to upload the case study? We just made a big groove from west to east and finally settling down, so I missed the last call and session. Yeah, if you're in CMDS, then we have another call coming up, another call just like this in December. We also have another CMDS call for case studies that you can upload. And we also have a big one. I can't remember if it's end of January, beginning of February, but we have like an all-day virtual retreat day where we can go over that as well. Yep. Okay, that's it there. Somebody's line is open. Let's see. Daniela, did you want to give input?
Yes.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi, you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Thank you. Last time you answered my question about my son, and he was diagnosed supposedly with GERD, but I'm not sure that's true by now. So you answered me some questions. You asked me if I was on the phone, and I ended up being just after that. I didn't know you addressed my question, so he's actually here with me if you wanted to ask more.
Okay, so you're going to have to completely tell me what the story was, because since then I've probably gone through, you know.
Yeah, he had gone to someone who said that he should be taking apple cider vinegar and in the morning and take manuka honey at night and take probiotics. And the probiotics, should give him a strong one, and Biomax. And it was like a war inside of him. And the other thing seemed to be irritating it. And he's taking some medication that lower stomach acid. And he's been taking it since early winter last year. I'm very concerned about it. He's living at home just now, but he was living away in another city and just going to medicate to doctors himself. At that time, I had written that he was recovering from psychosis. Mm. And he was on antibiotic drugs, and he was chain smoking, eating sugar mostly, and just, you know, he really wrecked his system and had that, he was filled with stomach acid, and sometimes he feels like he's having a heart attack. He's feeling things on the left side of his chest, mm-hmm. and I just took him to a biological dentist 2 days ago, and the dentist said, you know what, it doesn't sound like the way you're describing what you're feeling. It does not sound like GERD. And I'm wondering what that is. And that's why I asked about this, if the stomach is coming up above this, what I heard you talk about.
Hiatal hernia. Yeah. I would look into the hiatal hernia for sure. So here's the thing. Diagnoses are really somewhat useless. They're just labels to put people in boxes. GERD, which is reflux. It's basically reflux is a symptom. it's a symptom of the stomach doing something abnormally and dumping the contents up into the esophagus. So the question becomes, why? Is it because the lower
but he doesn't even feel anything. This is what he just told the dentist. I didn't even know that part. He doesn't even feel anything burning coming up. He feels the pain.
He doesn't feel burning.
He doesn't feel any acid coming up.
Just say, well, some people don't, and some people get a sore throat from it, and they cough. Some people feel it in their chest. Now, there's no way for me to know because I'm not examining him. But it seems to me like, why did they diagnose him with GERD? Did they do a GI series to see anything? Did they look down scope him to see if he had, gastroesophageal, irritation or inflammation?
No, he did it only with his lungs, not with his stomach.
Okay. And then they said, oh, it must be GERD because they ruled out it being his lungs or his chest or his heart. Is that correct?
They did a heart test.
They did a heart test, said your heart's fine. They did lungs, he's fine. But then they said, oh, it must be GERD. Here's some acid blockers.
Yes.
Okay. Did the pain go away? Did the chest pain go away when they started to give him when he started to take the acid blockers?
Yes, he was getting a sense of heat around the chest, and he's next to me, so I'm asking if when you started taking the medication, did the pain go away?
Yeah.
Yes, it did.
Only at high doses.
Only at high doses. Yeah. So I mean, it's possible that that's what it was. That's what it is, because if the antacids made it go away, it stopped the stomach acid, so it stopped the reflux. So if he was feeling a warmth in his chest, then it very well could be. A lot of times people mistake heart attacks for reflux. Now, he is young,
right. So,
you know, the chance of it being a high stomach acid is higher than for most people that are older. Like most of the time we see people with GERD, they're, you know, in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and stomach acid tends to go down anyway. But I think I don't know that it's a responsible thing to do to tell somebody they have GERD, put them on low stomach blockers, acid blockers, without actually knowing if he really is producing too much acid. And they could certainly scope them, which isn't a great thing to do, or they can do some imaging to see if there's erosion in the esophagus that's causing it, in which case you would think it's the stomach acid. They can also do imaging to see if he has a hiatal hernia. So my question goes back to, has he changed his diet, lifestyle ways, and has he stopped smoking and eating sugar, and is he on a really clean diet? Because those kind of things can help dramatically. But also, if there is a situation where an acid blocker is needed because there is too much acid, we always have to go, why? Why is it overproducing? Let's look at that. But also, you want to repair the damage. And just stopping the acid isn't going to repair the damage. So all the things we talked about in terms of upper GI protocols in the CMDS module, you know, in terms of demulcents and slippery elm and DGL and all these things that can help heal, you want to actually heal. You don't want to just stop the acid production. If it is too much acid, you want to actually heal it. So things like that, changing the diet dramatically to take out the things that actually interfere, like alcohol, cigarettes, coffee, heavy-duty foods, processed foods, sugar, all those things would need to be cleaned out of the diet to help it heal as well. And then I would say take them to a chiropractor, a kinesiology trained chiropractor that knows how to test for to see if there's a hiatal hernia, because it's an easier way to do it than imaging. You know, it's not as scientific, but muscle testing can be very helpful, and they can help to pull it back down. The other thing you could do is just go out to the YouTube. And do a search and see if you can help him or he can do it himself. You know, maybe you'd help him do it the first couple of times, and if it works, he could do it. And sometimes just doing that technique to pull the stomach down is very helpful and can be done, you know, every day for a couple of weeks until it actually stays where it's supposed to be. Now, there's things that cause it to get pushed up, overweight, right, obesity, so pregnancy.
Oh, he's slender? Yeah, he is he is slim, but when he was a teenager, young teenager, he had some kind of hernia or symptoms of it, and we were in a crash together, and the seat, he had just a seatbelt over his belly, and he got bruised up. It was a bad crash. My sternum actually broke, so it was pretty strong impact. So I wonder even if there's something
that
there.
Certainly can
know.
A trauma like that can cause, you know, all the organs to, because that compression there, that can certainly be a contributing factor. So I would definitely bring him to someone who knows how to kinesiologically test for it and rebalance that, and then do what you know how to do, which would be all the demulcents and repair and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. He says he feels everything on the left side of his ribcage, like to the left of the heart. It's not even in the middle, but that could be maybe referred from this esophagus anxiety.
The other thing, in taking him to somebody like a chiropractor who can look, he may have some ribs out of alignment. I mean, if he had that kind of a crash years ago and didn't actually have a thorough chiropractic evaluation, he may have some ribs that are not tracking properly. The diaphragm is connected there, so that could cause the diaphragm to actually be riding improperly, which could cause this. So if the penis feeling is way over, have him take a deep breath and see if that actually aggravates it, and bend in different directions, forward, back, to either side, twisting, and see if any of that aggravates or brings on that pain. Because I'd say, given that he had an accident, yes?
He's trying it as you speak.
Oh, good. It's always good to have the person right there.
He doesn't feel anything aggravated. And I have sent him to a very good chiropractor a few times, like a top guy. He didn't complain about the ribs with him, so I don't know if that would have had to be looked at specifically, but he didn't seem to be, when he worked on him, be alarmed about anything. He said about your ribs? But what? There's another clue here. He says when he has this kind of an attack, if he drinks baking soda and water, it calms things down.
Well, it's because if it actually, so that could be that it could be excess stomach acid, but also it could be that what's happening, that to me says that this whole reflux thing is not, you know, is not off base. Because when he does that, he's actually neutralizing the acid. So whatever irritation is happening to his diaphragm, you know, his esophagus, the lower esophageal sphincter, is being dissipated. So it just is another clue that, yes, indeed, the thing is a result of acid in the wrong place. Whether or not it's excess stomach acid, that's harder to tell. There are some tests you can do. It's in our home health thing. But there's actually some pH paper on a string that you can swallow and test to see what the acid is. There's a Heidelberg test, but there's only like a handful of people in all of North America that have that device where you swallow a transducer and then fish it out of the stool and then take it in, and they measure it and they know what the pH is. But I think that the biggest thing is healing it, right?
Yes. Avoiding. So I think that your protocol for that can't hurt anyway, right? To do all the medicines
That totally would be up. That's totally fine. Now the issue is he overproducing acid and why? And is he underproducing acid and why? But I would go through all those protocols, right? And the food is critical, and the manner in which he's eating, that calming and breathing and appreciation, you know, the whole protocol. It's not just picking and choosing. A lot of people just want to pick and choose. Okay, I'll just give him DGL, but now he's, meanwhile, he's scarfing down his food and still eating Cheetos. Know what I'm saying? So it has to be the whole protocol if we really want to restore balance. But I would not overlook, I mean, make sure that chiropractor knows, or check somebody else out, that he had this injury, the seatbelt injury, and that where he's feeling the pain is over to the left of the heart, which to me says that it could be rib stuff, right? Taking a deep, deep breath, does that cause it? Does that aggravate it?
Is there... I heard about a way of testing whether we have too much acid or too little acid by taking, I think it's a quarter teaspoon, I have to look it up again, of baking soda in a glass of water on an empty stomach. And then if in 30 seconds you burp, you know that it's high acid. And if you don't burp, it's low.
I don't know. You know, I don't know how
because
that works.
Because of the ischemic reaction, right, that it does with the hydrochloric acid and the baking soda, it causes the gas. And then
I mean, it could work. It's not one I'm familiar with, but it's certainly worth a try. It's real easy and cheap, right? Not cheaper than finding somebody with a Heidelberg machine and going in and swallowing a transducer, right? So, I would say try it and see. And the issue is why, right? He's obviously was under a lot of stress. Car accident and having, you know, smoking and all this other stuff. His system is under stress, but you want to heal the damage. You also want to figure out how do you get him under rebalance? Because if he stays on the antacids for a long period of time, he's going to not absorb his protein. He's not going to absorb his minerals, and we're going to lead to deficiencies that are going to lead to other problems down the road.
I think it's already happening because he's almost a year on it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I think it's already happening.
Yeah.
I'm so concerned about it.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to ask you more, you were talking, answering my question on a Q&A about the wheat. It's difficult because I'm off of wheat for 2 years. I heard Dr. O'Brien speak this weekend with you, but also other times, and I follow him. I have a family who still eats bread and a little bit at least, and I get a revolution here if I kick out of that.
I'd like to be able to tell you they can keep doing it and be healthy, and I can't in good conscience say that.
No, I know it's not. I know it's not. I just thought from, I think it was Green, Dr. Davis, who spoke about that there is a type of wheat that's more like the ancient wheat that is not as problematic, or maybe that's this.
Yeah, it could be less problematic, but if the person's already sensitized to it, then they're going to cross-react to it. They're going to react to it.
Which is most of us.
Yeah, of course.
Right? So it's still,
right. Yeah. So if you want to do them better, go that way. They say sourdough, small amounts. You get the einkorn and all that kind of stuff. But the point is, if they've already been sensitized to it, it's going to be could be a problem. So,
But isn't glyphosate maybe in a bigger problem?
Glyphosate's a huge problem. Huge problem.
I'm asking this because if they're going to have it anyway, then maybe I should bother to buy organic flour and make it myself, even though I'm not going to eat it. So at least they're not eating the regular bread.
Yeah, and they should be able to find it. But if they can't find it, I mean, I'm concerned about you if you're sensitive to it and you're handling it and you're, you know, that's not a good thing either. You're breathing it in. You got the. It's not a good thing.
I don't know if I'm that sensitive to it.
You don't know. Okay, keyword, I don't know.
I cut out dairy and wheat 2 years ago. That's it.
Yeah.
You know?
It only takes a morsel. So, I wouldn't feel comfortable having you be exposing yourself to it that way.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so see what you can find in terms of organic and all, you know.
Yeah,
but
okay.
Glyphosate's huge. And the glyphosate is also, because wheat is not GMO at this point.
Right.
So I'm not sure that organic is any better. And there was a reason that I learned from John Robbins recently, and the mechanism is not crossing my mind. It has to do with...
The question is only just so that it won't have glyphosate.
Yeah, right. It shouldn't have glyphosate if it's,
organic. I'm not thinking it's that much better. It's just that it doesn't have the glyphosate.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you find organic and, you know, let them, but that's just my opinion. I certainly wouldn't be making them bread. I want them off of it.
Yeah, so we are Jewish Orthodox, and on the Sabbath, people have challah bread, braided bread, right? Or some kind of bread that part of the meal at least twice, Friday night and Saturday lunch, and that's what they do. So during the week, a lot of them don't even have it, but they have it then. So I was trying to find a better solution.
Yeah.
I'm just doing it. Anyway. So I looked up what Dr. O'Brien said to go to PubMed and find the link, and I could not really find the link. There was one that I found, one study that actually said that it wasn't aggravating things. I couldn't find it.
He had those links, and he told you to go to a certain page, like thedoctor.com/ I can't remember what it was, Shine or something. And he had a whole bunch of links out there, the actual articles, not just the links.
On homocysteine and for RLS, for restless legs, he says to go.
Yeah.
He said to
I think he had that in his pack.
Look in his pack.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know because I haven't looked it up, but I know he said that it was there.
Oh, okay, great. Great. It was phenomenal. Thank you so much. That was amazing.
Oh, you're so welcome. It was amazing. Yeah, I thought so too. Thank you. All right, bye-bye.
Thank you so much for all your answers.
You're welcome. Okay, so let me put these hands down. And I don't see any more hands up, but let me look at the Q&A box, and then let me look at the other. And then I don't see Karen on the call who uploaded her 24-hour urine, so I'm not even going to open it if you're on the call. And again, it's not something that we typically would go over on a call like this anyway. And Lynn put a couple of good things, Daniela, in here. She said histamine and glutamate levels are higher in individuals with RLS, hyperarousal, likely too high histamine. And Bika says something about my son. He's having dark red to purple circles under his eyes and rough, dry skin, which starts peeling when redness reduces. I've taken him off of gluten and started glutamine. Doesn't seem to help much. What could be the reason? Should I take him? I would take him off all the top allergens because you don't know. It could be soy, it could be broccoli, it could be anything, but take them off all the top ones for sure, dairy and egg. But you know, also when you think about rough skin, it could be something else going on in his gut. He could have leaky gut, he could have candida, he could have some kind of overgrowth. But also when I think about the skin, I'm also thinking liver, and I'm also thinking essential fatty acids, that dry, rough, dry skin. Could also be related to a thyroid issue. So I don't know how old your son is, but those are some of the things that I would be looking at. And then Lynn says, histamines can fight infection, but when immune disorder is present, histamine levels can rocket, leading to side effects that contribute to RLS. So there you go with histamine levels, right? Because histamine, there's certain foods that contain histamines, and there are certain responses. And again, Dr. O'Brien talked about that a lot during his call. You remember he said to do the scratch across the belly to see if there's histamine levels going on? So looking at the foods and looking at the immune response to that. Another study from John Hopkins linked high glutamate with increased RLS symptoms. Glutamate levels rise when dopamine levels drop. Did you find out if it's a two-way street conversion? Can't find that. We have to look at pathways. I have a big chart somewhere in here of all the biochemical pathways. It's a book, and it's all these biochemical pathways. So I wanted to see if I can't picture that pathway. Usually I can picture the pathways in my brain. I can't picture whether it's a two-way arrow or a one-way arrow, because if that's indeed the case, then taking GABA can push backwards towards glutamate. So Lynn posted a whole lot of stuff on glutamate. Right, and typically that's what we would expect, that supplementing with GABA can help balance the appropriate levels of glutamate and dopamine. But again, usually glutamine, GABA in its standard form, doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier very well. And so if somebody is taking just a standard glutamate and they're getting results, it's oftentimes because of a leaky gut and a leaky blood-brain barrier. Although there's some people suggest that maybe the GABA in the gut is actually stimulating a vagus nerve response. Well, niacin, well, there's types of glutamate that are combined. They're actually combined chemically with it, and one is called picamilin brand, and that's a powdered form that I've gotten, and that seems to help with people to get across. So Ambika said your son is 14, also started him on a probiotic. He was prone to eczema since childhood. no microphone set up yet, so can only type. He's on 15 milligrams of glutamine. Yeah, so I would definitely look at his fatty acids and definitely look at his gut. How are his stools? Is he having more than one, hopefully 2 to 3 formed stools a day? Do they stink? Does he have bloating, gas, constipation, diarrhea? Does he have any signs? Run him through the gut assessment test to see what, where maybe there's something else going on in his gut. Eczema, you know, it could be liver related as well. Sometimes the herb yellow dot can be helpful in supporting that, but I'd also look in the liver section of the CMDS program as well. Glutamine isn't the only thing, and some people don't respond that well for it for leaky gut. So if you haven't already been to the leaky gut section of the program, go through that and just kind of play around and see what might help him. I would look behind his arms, on the back of his arms. Does he have that goose flesh like stuff? Oftentimes they do, and that can be a sign of fat soluble vitamin imbalance, AE, and also fatty acids. So I'd be looking at that as well. Oh, Lynn has a link to a how to fix a hiatal hernia video from Dr. David Williams. Okay, so in 2011, researchers from Quest Research Institute investigated GABA supplementation for RLS. Participants supplemented with GABA for 52 weeks. That's not a short-term study, is it? At the end of the study, 84% reported that their symptoms were improved very much. Also the gluten-free, but also the allergy-free, as we said before, Ambika. Let's see. Oh, no, that's not where it's Ambika. That was Daniela. Glycine interacts with GABA, which helps reduce tremors and inflammation. So it's found that supplementing with glycine. There we go. Let me see over here. Oh. Yeah. Okay. So let me go back. So I've got all the questions that have been typed in. That's great. And I'm going to look to see if any other hands are up. And Karen, you submitted a 24-hour urine. Which I, like I said, I would never have time to go over on a call like this. That's more of an NEPT thing that we go through 24-hour urines. If you're in CMDS, it's not really related to the gut. Those are very complicated tests. I could take a quick look at it if you're on the phone, but if you raise your hand, if you're not on the phone, I'm not going to do it. So just raise your hand, *2, and that'll let us know you're on the call. Otherwise, we will talk about it another time. Yeah, so Judy, that's the part I'm not remembering, whether GABA can turn into glutamate. I know glutamate can turn into GABA, and you need GAD, the glutamic acid decarboxylase, to go there. I just wasn't remembering whether it was the backwards, if it went backwards as well. So if that's the case, that would explain why Daniela's husband was getting agitated with the GABA. He was taking too much, and it was converting back to glutamate. Okay, we have a hand up in Whatcom County, Washington. Hello, who's that?
Hi, this is Steph. Yeah, I'm not really in
Washington. Oh, hi, Steph.
I just had a comment about the glutamine. I don't know if it would be helpful for anybody, but it can feed certain gut bacteria, in particular in the small intestine, which I think is what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And in particular, it's the E. coli. So I don't know if anyone has a gut test on anyone, but that would be one of the times when it might not be the most awesome plan.
Great.
I don't know if that helps. Yeah.
So that you're thinking that if they're supplementing the glutamine, that they could be feeding these particular gut bugs and causing it to get out of balance.
It particularly feeds E. coli and E. coli. A few other kind of SIBO-related bacteria, yeah. So then if there's, like, a skin issue and if it has anything to do with, like, the upper GI, then sometimes it can get worse.
Got it.
Glutamine, yeah. I also just want to say one quick thing about proton pump inhibitors.
Yeah.
Sometimes they, like, permanently reduce stomach acid, and ooh, that super sucks.
Yeah, especially if you're a young person. You have to go through your whole life without enough stomach acid. Ouch.
Yeah. but so really good that people are like testing to see why there's gastric reflux instead of just randomly blindly taking things. Yeah,
exactly.
Love it.
Exactly. Do you know any other tests besides Heidelberg and the swallowing the pH paper that can help identify?
I don't, and I really wish I did.
Yeah. Now that pH paper didn't see it wasn't expensive or anything, but it seemed like compliance issues might be big if you're having a string that they have to swallow the pH paper on a string and then you have to pull it back up.
I feel a bit of fear around that. Like,
there's a lot of fear around that. What about other causes? I mentioned a bunch. Do you have any other causes under your belt of why the stomach acid would get high? I mean, H. pylori, would that cause the stomach acid to go high? Should Daniela be checking her son maybe for H. pylori?
So H. pylori causes it to go lower, cause reflux.
Mm-hmm.
Which can cause reflux. So that could be, I mean, it's pretty, normal.
Yeah. So that's another thing to look for. So doing
because then if you have that, then you know it's too low. So you're not going to be doing.
Then you know it's
lowering it.
And you don't want to do something to even lower it more. And the thing is when exactly. So that might be another thing, Daniela, to do is to have them do a stool test for H. pylori. BioHealth has one. You can do the 401H, or you could just do. There's one that's just H. pylori. Yeah, just the H. Just the H. No 401, just the H. And that'll give him an idea of whether that's an issue. And if he has H. pylori come up, then likely the reflux is caused by low stomach acid, not high.
Yeah. Cool.
Okay. Cool. Thank you.
That was fun. Okay. See you later.
Welcome. All right. Bye. All right. I don't see any other there. I don't see any other here. Let's see. I'm going to refresh, and then we'll call it a day if I don't see any more questions. Karen, I'm here online. Thank you for mentioning. Was not sure if it could be reviewed on this call. I understand. Sure. I have about 2 minutes. I can tell you, the 30-second approach to it. If I can open it, hopefully. I did see it there. So we see Karen. Miami office hours. Karen. And this is a Genova, so I haven't done a lot of Genova. I'll turn on the recording just in case. I resume. Like I said, out of the scope of GI, but I haven't seen this one. This is a new way they do it. Usually I do Meridian. Looks like your progesterone metabolites are low. That's pregnenolone and trial. Your DHEA looks like it's on the low side. Testosterone's on the low side. Testosterone metabolites are okay. there's not a problem with DHT. Cortisol's right in the middle. Cortisol numbers don't look too bad. And that's just from looking there. Estrogen, overall, how old are you? Oh, let's see. Karen is 64. So, you're in that time range. Hi, Karen, are you on?
Yes.
Oh, good. Yeah. So, how old are you? 64. So you'd be like 54?
52.
Okay. 52. Menopausal, still having periods?
Menopausal. I had an ablation a year ago.
Okay.
Endometrial ablation.
Yeah. Okay. So your 2-hydroxys are good. Your 2-methoxys are actually really good. So that's good. See this, the one here. Your 2-hydroxys are on the lower side, but your overall numbers are. Your estrone is 5.2. Your estradiol is 2.2. Your estriol is 3.3. So you're low in estriol. I can tell that because the estriol should be more than, equal to or more than the sum of estrone and estradiol. And yours is about a 2 to 0.5 ratio. It should be 1 or higher. So, you'd look at things like, do you have an iodine deficiency? That's usually an issue. They give you some really great graphs, I think, further down in here. So let's see where we can go with that. 4-hydroxy is low, so that's good. So the dangerous metabolites are really low. What's your 4-216? Is actually your 2-16 ratio is pretty good. The 2 is fairly in the same range. I don't know if they actually mark these anywhere, so I'm just going through. I've never seen this particular report before. Like I said, I usually do Dutch or The other one, let's see, this is what the sample of pie charts.
Of course, I learned about Dutch after having this test done, so.
Oh, yeah. Much easier. Carrying around that bucket for 24 hours is a pain. Yeah, methylation activity, so your 2:16 ratio is kind of, you know, on the lower end of the green range. Your methylation.
I'm sorry. May I ask? I'm sorry. 2:16 ratio is.
Yeah,
what is
2
that?
Is the protective estrogen. 16 is one of the more dangerous ones. So we like to see the 2:16 ratio, and yours is looking good. You don't want it too low. Sometimes people have a lot higher 2 hydroxy versus 16, and that's not good for bone health. So yours is in a good range.
Great.
And your 4 hydroxys are, you know, off the charts low, so that's good. But your progesterone's quite low. Pregnenolone here. Your DHEA is quite low. Your metabolites are pretty good. So you'd want to be looking at, remember I handed out a chart at Shine, and it was a really complicated chart, and I said you were going to have to memorize it by the end of Shine. Remember that one?
Yes, I remember.
That one. Take a look at that and really study in terms of where you are and what some of the cofactors might be that are causing you some problems. I was.
Okay.
It's not showing. Let's see. Well, it'll be on the recording. There we go. There you go. Yeah, so if we look back at her first page, this is what I was looking at first. Estrogen metabolites. This is where I found her estriol. Is 3.3, but the estrone and estradiol combined come out to be 7.4. So she's clearly doesn't have enough estriol. Oftentimes it's an iodine deficiency, so you may want to look at that. You can do an iodine load test if you want to, but this is a functional test for low iodine. This is
okay.
A metabolite for progesterone, so that's low. DHEA is low, but some of these metabolites are all in an okay range. Testosterone's super, super low. So I would be looking at why would the metabolites be higher, but the testosterone DHA itself? So look at those pathways to see. We don't have time to go through all those pathways, but you can look at those pathways to see how, like what other substances might be interfering. The glucocorticoids are actually pretty good. There's a little bit off here, but, this is a metabolite of cortisol. So here's the estrone. They don't actually give you the ratio, but you can see. And you know, you can't just look and say, oh, well, they're in the low end. They're all in the low end of normal because actually, which doesn't make sense that they would say that, but, you know, really if the estriol is 3.3, you want these guys to be even lower than that to make the total of them 3.3 or less. Yeah, I like seeing the 4-hydroxy really low. I like seeing the 2-methoxy in that nice and the decent range. It means that the methylation is actually happening.
Okay.
Anabolic, catabolic. So here's one that I haven't seen before. So 2-hydroxy-E1 plus E2 divided by 2-methoxy-E1 plus E2. And it's very skewed, but I don't remember seeing where the other one is because it looks like your methoxy. I didn't see E1 and E2, so let me look at that. Your T3 looks okay. So let me go back to that real quick because it's got my curiosity up. Here's methylation.
Okay.
2-hydroxy-E, let's see, maybe it's on the other page. This is kind of cool because you can relate it back to your SNPs, the CYP1A1, and it may explain why some of these things are also 2-hydroxy. Yeah, I don't see it actually listing. Let me see up here. Like I said, I've never looked at this test before, so I'm just hunting based on the other tests. So I don't see where they're listing they're just listing the total. But over here, it looked like, so here's the methoxy. and the hydroxy. So I'm not sure why that later one is saying the methoxy is bad, because the methoxy is right there in the middle of the range, and the hydroxy is at the low end. So to me, it looks like it's fine. So I'm not sure what the interpretation is related to the COM-T SNP. So not sure why they say that down here. So it's got me very curious.
You're talking about the last page where it shows that.
Yeah, exactly. On the last page.
Okay.
Where it says the 2-methoxy.
E1 plus E2.
That looks good, but there was another place where it said it wasn't good. That's just the 4-methoxy. Anyway, maybe I misread it. But I thought I saw somewhere where it was saying that you weren't methylating well, but to me it looks like you're methylating just fine. Oh, here.
And that was the interpretation I also got from the functional practitioner I'm working with. But
Yeah, this is the one I was looking at. So the 2-hydroxy divided by the 2-methoxy. But when we looked up here, your hydroxy, I don't see why that's a problem. Oh, yours is, I don't know why it's red. You know, it's a standard thing, but I would think, in my humble opinion, that you're actually over the top high on methylation, which is actually not a bad place to be. So I'd ignore this last one and go by the other one. That's just my opinion. You said your functional doc said the same thing. So anyway, that's basically what I have to say. Whoops, it just started raining.
Okay. I really appreciate the review and the feedback. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, no problem. My pleasure. Okay, bye.
Awesome. Thanks, bye.
Yeah. All right, so we're going to go back and I believe we're going to go back to conference, see if any other hands are up. I don't see any other hands up. And let's see, I'll go to Q&A. Elaine, is this an appropriate question? I submitted it somewhere else, but now I'm thinking it was the wrong place. Wondering about an 18-year-old, 100-pound woman with high anxiety, panic attacks. This is more of a case study. What's the question? Panic attacks, sensory overwhelm. Pre-T3, 3.2, which is fine. Pre-T4, 1.36, fine. The ratio looks fine. Reverse T3, 18, that looks fine in relationship. TSH, 2.5, looks fine. LDL cholesterol, 117, looks a little high. MCHC, ferret, and I'm not going to try to analyze all this like this. This is not a good way to do it. Within NEPT, when we submit these, we put them on our spreadsheet. Remember, if you were at Shine, you saw that I showed you that really cool spreadsheet. That's the way to submit these, because otherwise, you know, I'm not a genius. I can't figure this out. Hang on, I got to shut my window or my printer's going to get wet. Okay, there we go. Yeah, so, you know, I could tell those 6-hormone-binding globulin D, 70 looks good. Carbon dioxide, 21 is low. Cortisol, 11, I don't care about them in blood. Eats 99% GF mostly. Mostly DF, dairy-free. Doctor suggested more red meat, add 5-HTP, and come back in a year? Holy cow. Phew! Too complicated for me to really go through. I would say her thyroid numbers look good. And you'd be looking in a lot of other places, right? High anxiety, panic attacks. I'd be wanting to do like an oat test to see what her, neurotransmitter metabolites are like. I don't know what she's eating, what her protein's like, what her stomach acid is like. But I think just eat more red meat and 5-HTP and come back in a year is a little bit, like there's a lot going on here. So you want to know why. Does she have gut dysbiosis? Does she have an overgrowth that might be contributing to lack of her various neurotransmitters, feedback, low GABA, low dopamine, et cetera? So, yeah, I will look at B12 as a possibility, but I don't see MCV there. Ferritin 40, estradiol, yeah. Yeah, so I can't read this. I can't read this in its entirety that way, but I could tell you from there the thyroid looks decent and her vitamin D looks decent. She's in an acidic state. Her carbon dioxide is low. I would say get her off the dairy completely if there is a sensitivity, mostly doesn't work. And I'd be looking for other food sensitivities. I'd be looking for gut bugs. I'd be looking for low stomach acid, amino acid insufficiencies, and a whole bunch else. So that's about it. Okay, I think we're done. I'm going to take a break before my next thing, like a 3-minute break, because that's when my next call starts. Let's see. Okay. So Judy says she gets more irritable with GABA. So if somebody can find that chart to see if it does go both ways, if that's the case, then some people, you know, everybody's unique. So if excess GABA can then get converted back to glutamate, then that's going to cause it. So good. Thank you, Judy. We're going to look. If you find any charts, biochemical pathways you can send our way, that'd be great. Okay, great. Have a great one, everybody. I'll open up the line so you can all say goodbye. I'm going to save this recording, screenshot recording. Okay, because some people didn't see it, so we'll load it up there. This is INE office hours. Office hours, and what's today? Can't believe it's November already. It's crazy. Okay. No, it's the 3rd. Save it. All right. We're good. Okay. So I'll open up your lines so you can say goodbye to each other. Bye-bye, everybody. Thank you for coming.
Bye-bye.
See you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
You're welcome.